As time went on, the onslaughts just seemed to get worse. The first, under Nero, was brutal, but at least it was limited to the city of Rome. Beginning with the persecution that made Origen fatherless, however, they began to become more systematic, affecting the entire empire. Decius's persecution, which sent Cyprian into hiding and Origen into prison, was a shock. But Valerian's attack on the church just a few years later reached new heights of ruthlessness. Just a year after he martyred Cyprian, Valerian got a shock of his own. He won the distinction of being the only Roman emperor ever to be captured in battle. Once the Persians got their hands on him, he was never heard from again. So thankfully, his persecution, like his reign, was short-lived. Perhaps Gallienus believed his father's disgrace to be a result of God's judgment. That would explain what happened as soon as he became emperor in AD 260. This offspring of the most brutal persecutor in history not only eased up on the Christians, he formally decreed by force of law that they could henceforth worship freely, own property, and even hold political office. It seemed like a dream come true. Church buildings, even large basilicas, went up across the empire. Christians began to work their way up through the ranks of the military and the government. Granted, it was a bad time for the empire as a whole. 25 different emperors ruled and died within the space of only 50 years, most killed by their own soldiers. The once prosperous Roman economy, based on extensive trade between provinces, was contracting at breakneck speed. Provinces were lopped off left and right as the Persians hammered the empire from the east and the barbarians from the north. Despite all this, the church grew by leaps and bounds. One prominent historian estimated that in AD 260, about 1 million Christians lived in the empire. But by AD 300, there were 6 million, or about 10 to 15% of the empire's inhabitants. Some of the growth even came from prominent families entering the church. By the end of the 3rd century, Christians could be found in the imperial court and among every profession in the empire. By that time, the myths about incest and cannibalism among Christians had been largely debunked. Of course, there were many who still hated Christians. The pagan intelligentsia found them ignorant, ridiculous, and appalling. Anybody with a financial interest in pagan worship, priests, priestesses, augurs, diviners, fortune tellers, and statue makers, loathed the Christians for destroying their businesses. Many in the army and government still suspected them of disloyalty to the empire. Imagine the gall of Christians refusing to participate in patriotic festivals like the 1,000-year anniversary of the founding of the city of Rome, just because they objected to obligatory sacrifices to the gods that had brought such glory and wealth to the city? Fanatical, ungrateful, and treasonous. This era of instability and turmoil came to an end in AD 284. When a man named Diocletian was raised to the imperial purple. Here was somebody with the courage to make bold changes in response to the chaos and decline that had plagued the empire for the previous 50 years. He just faced facts. The empire was simply too large to be ruled by one man alone. In the days of the Republic, there had been many to share decision-making power. So Diocletian came up with a far-reaching plan of reorganization. The empire would be divided in half, east and west. These regions would in turn be divided in half. There would be four emperors, a senior emperor or Augustus in the east, and another in the west. Their junior emperor assistants would be called Caesars. Every emperor would directly rule a fourth of the empire, with each Caesar reporting to his Augustus and the two Augusti keeping in close touch with each other in order to craft common policy and preserve unity. Four new capitals near the frontiers were selected so that the emperors could more quickly respond to any incursion by barbarians or Persians. This was a rather magnanimous and humble thing for Diocletian to do, voluntarily share power with three others. One of the far-reaching effects of this reorganization was not foreseen by Diocletian, but is now apparent in hindsight. The line he drew separating the eastern half of the empire from the western half accelerated something that had already quietly begun, a growing cultural divergence between the Latin-speaking west and the Greek-speaking east. Before Diocletian in AD 200, the North African author Tertullian had written with equal ease in both Greek and Latin. 20 years later, in Rome, Hippolytus was still writing his theology not in Latin, but in Greek. By the end of Diocletian's reign, however, few in Rome or Carthage could read a Greek text with any fluency. And no one in the East beside government employees bothered to learn Latin, considered by the Easterners to be a barbarous tongue. Nevertheless, Diocletian enjoyed a great deal of success in his program to reverse the disintegration of the Roman government. He reformed the tax code, reorganized the army, and pushed back the enemy. He wanted to restore the glory days of the empire. This, of course, required paying renewed homage to the gods that had made Rome great. At first, there was no hint that he would put any pressure on the Christians. Indeed, right across the street from his imperial residence in Nicomedia, the new capital of the Eastern Empire, loomed a huge Christian basilica. He even had some Christians in his imperial court. Diocletian was generally a man who wanted to bring different sorts of people together in the great society that was Rome. By temperament, he was not the sort of ruthless and tolerant ruler that many of his predecessors had been. Diocletian was Augustus of the East. His Caesar, Galerius, was of a different cast of mind altogether. The junior emperor agreed with a cadre of pagan intellectuals and military advisors who disdained the Christians as an unpredictable and heterogeneous element in society. Egged on by Galerius, these imperial advisors tried to convince Diocletian that Christianity presented an obstacle to the very restoration of Roman tradition that was his life's program. Diocletian was reticent to concur. But when Galerius made the case that the loyalty of the army was in question, Diocletian reluctantly agreed to grant Galerius free rein to shore up military discipline by whatever means he saw fit. At first, it didn't seem too bad. Christian soldiers were not imprisoned or killed, they just had to sacrifice or resign. Resignation, however, entailed the surrender of their pension, which included a parcel of land and a lifetime income. Despite the financial consequences, most Christian officers chose to resign rather than deny their faith. A few compromised, of course. There are always a few. A great campaign against the Persians concluded successfully in AD 299. And so a formal celebration was planned in Antioch to be attended by Diocletian, Galerius, and their courtiers. Naturally, sacrifices and divination were part of such occasions. But as the festivities got underway, an unusual problem arose. The augurs, responsible to read omens from the gods, could not decipher the entrails of the sacrificed animals, even after repeated attempts. This was an embarrassing disruption of what should have been a triumphant celebration. When Diocletian demanded an explanation for this outrage, the augurs said that they'd noticed Christians from the emperor's own court making the sign of the cross, and this had blocked their divinations. Diocletian was furious and demanded punishment for the Christians in the palace. The first blood was spilled, and the clouds began to gather. Galerius now saw his chance. He capitalized on this incident to lobby for a systematic crackdown on the Christians. But still, Diocletian hesitated. They came up with a solution. They would ask the advice of the oracle of Apollo at Miletus. The pagan priestess put their question to the god and got this reply. The just on earth had silenced the oracles. Diocletian's advisors told him that this most certainly referred to the Christians. Diocletian finally was convinced that something must be done. Thus, after 40 years of peace, the storm finally broke. On February 23, 303 AD, the Christian basilica across from the imperial palace was razed to the ground. The next day, an empire-wide edict was issued. Effective immediately, all Christian buildings were to be destroyed, sacred scriptures and liturgical vessels seized, and meetings forbidden. All Christians holding office in the military or government would immediately lose their positions. This applied even to senators and members of the equestrian order. Christian freedmen, the decree stated, would now revert back to their former status as slaves. Many officials carried out their orders half-heartedly. They knocked on doors and asked Christians for their sacred books. Some gave them nothing and were hauled in for prosecution. Some handed over the scriptures. Others gave the police heretical volumes or even medical textbooks written in Greek, passing these off as sacred books to the police who read only Latin. The police often could care less what they got as long as it looked like they were doing their job. In the following year, a second and even harsher edict was issued. All Christian clergy, of whatever rank, were to be imprisoned. Historians from the era said that the number of bishops, priests, deacons, subdeacons, lectors, and exorcists who flooded the prisons was so great that there was no room for common criminals. Diocletian decided to soften his second edict. Clergy could be released as long as they were willing to offer sacrifice. Diocletian's second decree was ignored by the Caesar of the Western Empire, a man named Constantius. But Constantius's domain was limited mainly to Gaul and Britain. His Augustus, who was in charge of Italy and North Africa, took both edicts more seriously. In the East, the decrees were implemented everywhere with vehemence. Some clergy caved in and sacrificed. Many of the jailers either sympathized with the Christian clergy or just wanted to get them out of their overcrowded jails. Frequently, those who refused to sacrifice were given certificates anyway, just to get rid of them. However, other local officials relished the opportunity to take action against the Christians. No general death sentence was part of the imperial decrees, yet. But governors always had the right to mete out capital punishment at their discretion. When it came to dealing with Christians, some governors were pleased to exercise this option as often as possible. Diocletian's health declined in the second year of the persecution, so he did something no other emperor had ever done. He voluntarily abdicated, retired to his magnificent seaside palace, and spent the rest of his life tending his vegetable garden. Galerius advanced to become Augustus of the East. Now, unrestrained by the scruples of his former boss, he used his new authority to compel everyone in the empire to offer sacrifice or face death. Thus began the most gruesome phase of a persecution that had already lasted longer than any other. In one case, all the citizens of a Christian town in Phrygia unanimously refused to offer the required pagan sacrifices. The town was promptly surrounded by soldiers and set ablaze, with no one, man, woman, or child, allowed to escape. But hope came from the West. In AD 306, Constantius died and his army acclaimed his son, Constantine, as the new emperor. Constantine and his father had been worshippers of Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun. This divinity had been the military's deity of choice for more than a generation. However, there was Christian influence somewhere in the family, for Constantine had a half-sister named Anastasia, meaning resurrection. Immediately upon succeeding his father, Constantine decreed religious freedom in the provinces controlled by him, including Gaul and Britain. His not-too-friendly co-emperor Maxentius was not going to allow his colleague to outdo him in winning the allegiance of the sizable Christian minority. So, he reluctantly followed suit and took the pressure off the Christians in Rome and Africa, where he was in control. Meanwhile, in the East, the persecution continued unabated. What happened next proved to be decisive for the history of Christianity and Western civilization as a whole. Maxentius, who had seized Italy, wanted to consolidate and extend his power. He had defeated several of his rivals and built an army in Italy of over 100,000 troops. He saw that Constantine stood in the way of his ambitions, and so he declared war on him. Rather than wait for Maxentius to come to him, Constantine decided to make his move. He would boldly march his army from Gaul over the Alps and attack Maxentius on his own turf. This was against all earthly prudence, said his advisors. Constantine had fewer than 40,000 troops to his rival's 100,000. In addition, Constantine would be fighting on enemy territory, where Maxentius controlled both the roads and the food supply. Constantine nevertheless followed his instincts and launched his daring campaign. He encountered armies and fortified cities every step of his way down the Italian peninsula. After a chain of stunning victories, he found himself directly across the Tiber from the gates of Rome. Maxentius had shrewdly destroyed all the bridges, and so was protected behind both the Tiber and the massive Aurelian wall surrounding the city. Two surprising things happened next. First, Constantine had a dream wherein God showed him a symbol and told him to make it his standard. It was what looks to us today like an X with a P superimposed on it. In Christian symbolism, it is known as the Kairo, the first two letters of the word Christ in Greek, and thus Jesus' monogram. Obedient to the divine command, Constantine had this Christian emblem emblazoned on the shields and banners of his army. He was confident that under this sign he would be victorious with the help of God. The second remarkable thing was a strategic decision made by Maxentius after consulting his gods. He abandoned the safety of both the walls of the city and the Tiber, which served as its moat. Contrary to all common sense, he and his army crossed the Tiber on a bridge made of boats to meet Constantine on the open field of battle, their backs to the river. Despite his superior numbers, Maxentius was pushed back to the Tiber where the Milvian Bridge lay in ruins. In the confusion of retreat and the absence of a solid bridge, Maxentius fell into the water and drowned along with many of his troops. Constantine entered the city hailed as a liberator. To honor Constantine, the Senate even commissioned a large triumphal arch to be erected adjacent to the Colosseum, elaborately sculptured with scenes from the momentous battle of the Milvian Bridge. The story of the Kairo, told to us by Lactantius, advisor of Constantine, is borne out by the fact that coins minted under Constantine contained the Kairo symbol. Whatever had been his previous devotion to Sol Invictus, he attributed his victory to Christ and considered himself from then on a Christian believer. So what became of Galerius, the instigator of the great persecution? He had taken ill the year previous to the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. Knowing he was on his deathbed, he issued a decree of religious toleration for Christians, which, believe it or not, included a request that they pray for him. Before he died, Galerius appointed Licinius to succeed him as Augustus. The year after the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, Constantine met Licinius in Milan. Together, they promulgated a formal empire-wide decree of toleration, not just for Christians, but for everyone of whatever creed. All would be allowed to follow their religious convictions in peace. But for the Christians whose property had been unjustly destroyed by the state, there would be monetary compensation. Scriptures, sacred vessels, and churches would all be replaced at government expense. This momentous legislation, enacted in AD 313, came to be known as the Edict of Milan. Constantine had already made good on this pledge of restitution even before the decree was issued. Within 2 months of his victory, he made the decision to part with a historic palace situated on the Caelian Hill that had come to him as part of the dowry of his wife Fausta. This patrimony, which had once belonged to the noble Lateran family, was donated to the church to serve as the site of the city's cathedral and episcopal residence. What came to be known as St. John Lateran was to remain the papal residence for another 1,000 years. Its basilica still stands today as the official cathedral of Rome and mother church of Western Christendom. The current residence of the Pope was originally another gift of Constantine to the church. A few years after the Edict of Milan, Constantine erected a basilica over the tomb of St. Peter on the hill across the Tiber, known as the Vatican, where Peter was martyred. When the pagan Licinius began to renege on his word and harass Christians in the East, Constantine took military action. After handily defeating Licinius in AD 324, both by land and sea, Constantine became the sole ruler of the empire. The great persecution had lasted 11 long years in the East. The peace that followed put an end to 300 years of spasmodic persecution of the fledgling church by the Roman state. Constantine had not forced Christianity upon the empire, but while he lived, he was determined that the empire would never again force paganism on Christianity. The peace of Constantine left the Christian community jubilant, yet at the same time divided. New rigorous groups arose in Egypt and Carthage that refused fellowship to anyone who had cooperated with the police in any fashion whatsoever during the Great Persecution. Whether they actually sacrificed to the gods, handed over the scriptures, or medical textbooks or heretical writings in lieu of the scriptures, didn't matter. They were all traditores, traitors, who had compromised their faith and could never again be trusted. Their pollution would defile anyone who would accept them into communion. This new rigorous schism made the one in Cyprian's day look like child's play. It would go on to haunt the North African church for the next 3 centuries. But a far greater threat to the unity of the church began to brew in Alexandria even before the final victory of Constantine over Licinius. This menace represented an attack on the very identity of Jesus Christ and his relationship to God the Father, and so threatened to poison the heart of the Christian faith. This doctrine took only a couple of years to split the church in Alexandria. Left unchecked, it was apparent that it could divide the church across the empire. Constantine, not yet baptized, understood little about theology, but even he realized that this challenge had to be dealt with decisively and done so quickly.